This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy and features real testimonials.
This was our first time trying therapy, and honestly, it was long overdue. Looking back, we just wish we had started sooner.
Regain's qualified therapists help couples when they can't get there on their own.
We thought it was intimacy issues, but Andrea helped us uncover a deeper root cause we hadn't even realized was there.
Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. Regain, powered by BetterHelp.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip: when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one-coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Rebate in form of Visa gift card equal to 100% off the second eligible item purchased before or after applicable discounts, if any. See details. Offer ends 7/9.
What is the most disturbing deathbed confession you've ever heard? Story 1. Not a confession, but a pretty funny story about my grandfather. I was the closest person to him in the family. I was flying home to try and see him and missed him passing by an hour. When I arrived, everyone started asking me questions. Apparently, he sat up in bed, turned to the others and said, "Let me tell you a story. I'm not his name. I am an assassin, and my name is Jonas McGilfrey. I've hidden $2 million in gold bullets." He then laid down and passed away. The entire family figured I had to know about it because of how close we were. I used to skip school and go to his house all the time when he got a new silent film on VHS. I had no idea what he was talking about. The family spent a lot of time trying to figure it out. I stumbled across the answer a few years later. He was a big Louis L'Amour fan. I wasn't, but on a whim, I picked up a book and started reading. Right there, the book started out, "I'm not X, my name is Jonas McGilfrey, SP, and I've hidden $2 million in gold bullets." I know it's not exactly how it was worded in the book, but it was close enough. It's been almost 30 years now. I gave the book to my mom and she shared it with the family. It's so like my grandfather to pull something like this, honestly. He was an absolute character in life. I miss him greatly and man, I still laugh at this. Story 2. Not quite a confession, but near the end of my mom's life, she asked, "Where are my boys?" My twin and I thought she meant girls, so we told her we were there. After she died, the day before the funeral, we got a call from a private investigator asking if they could speak to my mom. I told them she had just passed away, and the PI shared that they represented a client looking for their biological mother. I seriously thought it was someone who somehow heard my mom had passed and was trying to get money. At the time, I was grieving, so it seemed plausible. I decided to hear her out, and she was absolutely describing my mother and parts of her life that no scammer would have known. Come to find out, our mother had 2 boys from 2 different men prior to marrying our father. One of the men was from her hometown, the other was from Japan. So much of her life before our dad was suddenly an enigma. Both her sisters had Alzheimer's, so no information was ever shared with us. Story 3. It's nowhere near the level of what some of these are,
but growing up, my mother and grandmother had always been very estranged. They had an arm's-length relationship, and the only times we visited were generally a disaster. But to her credit, my mom tried and wanted me to have a grandmother and the memories that came with it. She tried her best, but something was very off. Small details trickled out over the years, but they were vague. When it was time for my grandmother to die, I remember visiting her on her deathbed. My mother did not, and my grandmother told me right before she passed, "Tell your mother I always really loved her, despite everything." That was a strange thing for her to say, because why would that have been something she needed to say? I didn't tell my mom right away, because after my grandmother died, she was oddly emotionless, and I felt like it was not something my mom needed to hear just then. A few years later, the truth came out during a phone conversation. My mom told me that when she was 5, my grandmother tried to run her over with a car because she found out her affair partner was hurting my mother. She wanted to get rid of her. It didn't work because a neighbor saw and intervened, so my mom ended up getting sent overseas to her father's mother's home to be safe, while that got dealt with and my grandparents got divorced. Times being what they were, however, when my mom returned, her mother got custody of her. It ended with my mother running away, being homeless, getting pregnant very young by a much older man, a secret sister I never knew about, and I was pretty floored. When she told me, I figured it made a little more sense why my grandmother had said that, so I shared it with my mother finally. She just said, "Well, she had a strange way of showing it, and that was that." Story 4. I don't think I'd call this a confession, but it happened just before he died. I volunteered at a hospice, and there was a guy who had pretty severe memory decline. Before he passed, he started reliving a moment from when he was drafted for Vietnam. He mistook me and another volunteer for his war buddies, and apparently they had harmed a man and his family when they got back. From what he was saying, it wasn't supposed to be the whole family, but things spiraled, and they ended up harming the man, his wife, and her parents. He was unnervingly calm, not panicked, just calculated. He didn't acknowledge anything we were telling him either. He was stuck in that memory. He was in the middle of going over how to hide the bodies when he slipped back into his normal self and then refused to talk about it anymore with anyone. He passed away shortly before dinner time the same day. Story 5. I used to care for people with various disabilities in their homes. One man I cared for was elderly, over 80 years old, and just needed help with day-to-day things like cooking and cleaning, driving places, etc. He was a very inappropriate guy and always had something to say to the ladies. He had cognitive issues, especially with impulse control, which led to lots of inappropriate comments to women, theft from stores, and random fast walks that required redirecting him back to the house. One evening, we were sitting on his porch, and he asked me what the date was. After I told him, he got very emotional and sad, and shared that it was the day he lost his family. I knew he had no family who visited or cared for him, and that he had been looked after by agencies for decades. I saw the obituaries he had hanging in the house, and only one mentioned him as a survivor. It was clear the family stopped including him when he was young. He said that when he was a teenager, he touched his little sister. When she told, he harmed her fatally. He shared details of how he buried her under a sign next to the road. He described the dress she was wearing, and how mommy was never the same, and daddy tried to hurt me when they found her. I'll never know for certain if it was a false memory from his cognitive decline, or if he shared the reason he had no family in his life and was not mentioned in any of the obituaries of his parents and siblings, only in the one of his grandmother. But I will say I believed him as he was telling me. It felt different from any of his other stories that you knew were probably not true or were exaggerated. He passed away a couple of weeks later. Story 6. Not a deathbed confession, but when my aunt was a college student in the late 1960s, she applied for a grant to study ecology in Borneo. She delayed accepting her fiancé's proposal while she waited for an answer. She waited and waited and waited. My grandmother, who was a huge fan of my aunt's fiancé, worried that the relationship wouldn't survive if she took off to Borneo for a year. She was incredibly relieved when my aunt took the radio silence as a rejection and accepted his proposal. Decades later, living a happy life with a successful husband and 3 high-achieving daughters, my aunt mentioned something about the time she wanted to study in Borneo. That was when my grandmother told her that the day before the wedding, an envelope came to my grandparents' house telling my aunt her grant application had been approved. Concerned she would spoil her future,
My grandmother threw the envelope in the trash. Story 7. One weekend, a patient with memory issues kept repeatedly telling me about someone he and his friends beat up and harmed after the war. I assumed it would have been around the early 1950s. Apparently, they took his wallet, but what struck my attention was the undertone and the lack of panic in his voice. Usually, patients who think something is lost or stolen are very anxious. He wasn't. He just kept saying he and his buddies beat him up bad and took his wallet, and I'm 99.8% sure he was talking about a racially motivated attack. The timing adds up, and his details of the event were too clean. He was a respectful guy with a good family, wife, and kids. A good Midwestern family man. Something happened with him and his friends one night, and it wasn't good. There was a regret to the story, but it really just seemed like he wanted to finally tell someone. I've been a nurse 15 years. I worked in a locked dementia unit at the start of my career. I did the week-long dementia state certifications to become a trainer. I sadly know dementia well, and I interact well with them. You just go to their world and live there with them. This was different, though. He kept repeating the same story all weekend, and the details didn't change. That's unusual for someone with dementia. It wasn't a story or behavior he was known for, repeating over and over again either. I'm convinced that guy was reliving that night from 60 years ago and telling me something real. It wasn't a dementia false reality. I'll never forget him. I still know what room he was in and everything about it. Only time I've been spooked, and I've literally had 2,000 plus patients and called 100 plus deaths. This was different. Story 8. Not really a confession because he didn't do anything wrong, but when I was an 18-year-old CNA, I had a patient who was a very sweet elderly man. He was in our facility on hospice as he didn't want his family to have to provide his end-of-life care. I was with him every day. I worked for over a month, and we got along extremely well. I was very close to my grandparents and great-grandma, so I get along very well with elderly people and enjoy conversations with them. This patient was a World War II vet. As he got closer to death, he wanted to talk about his experiences in the war. He said he never talked to his family about them because he didn't want them to live with that knowledge, but he just needed to talk, and I said I didn't mind. I sat with him for a while after my...
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy and features real testimonials.
This was our first time trying therapy, and honestly, it was long overdue. Looking back, we just wish we had started sooner.
Regain's qualified therapists help couples when they can't get there on their own.
We thought it was intimacy issues, but Andrea helped us uncover a deeper root cause we hadn't even realized was there.
Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. Regain, couples therapy that works.
You have 5 new messages. Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again. Sally from Finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Shift and made him tea. He told me about how he was the pilot of one of the boats that carried soldiers to Omaha Beach on D-Day. He said it was the worst thing he ever did. Knowing many of those men and boys would die, listening to them being sick and scared, and then cleaning what was left of some of them out of the boat after. He said he felt tremendous guilt about carrying them to their deaths for the rest of his life. I didn't really know what to say. I just listened. I thanked him for being so brave and told him that none of those people would have wanted him to feel guilty for doing his part, and that they would be waiting to see him when he got to heaven so they could tell him so. I hope it helped. Story 9. I work as an ER nurse. And a couple of months ago, there was a massive crash on the highway with around 20 cars. It was apparently a mystery who caused it. But because so many people were hurt and no one knew whose fault it was, they didn't know whose insurance was going to pay for everything.
Because the treatments were super expensive for many of the patients, most insurances would only partially cover the bills. There was one older man who was in the car with his wife, and his wife died on impact. In his last moments, he told me to put the blame on him, to tell everyone he confessed to causing the crash. He did it because his insurance was top tier, and he knew it would help people. Not very disturbing, but I think it's pretty interesting. Story 10. I'm a nurse, and I have been for a long time. When I first became a nurse, I worked in long-term care. Not because I wanted to, but because it was all I could get. After reading through these stories, I'm realizing that two of the ladies I loved working with were confessing things to me rather than their families. Both were pretty tame, considering. The first one was a lady who came from an affluent background and had a large, loving, extended family. Her confession was that she was an alcoholic for many years and hid it from her family. The second lady's story was a little more personal. Her first husband was very abusive, and she tried to leave him. She ended up having an affair with his friend, and something like four of her seven children were the friend's. She ended up having to leave one night with just the clothes on her back, and she and the abusive husband's friend lived happily ever after until he passed away from cancer. She said she couldn't wait until it was her time too, so she could be with him again. Story 11. When my great-grandfather, who partially raised me, was on his deathbed, he said that he never loved my grandma, and that every time he accidentally ran over her foot with his heavy wheelchair and she screamed for him to move, and he took his sweet time pretending to be confused. It was on purpose. He said that when he got drunk and violent, he wasn't actually that drunk. He just wanted to hurt her. And that when he accidentally made her fall and crack her head open, he was genuinely trying to kill her. Every time she had a health scare, he prayed to God that she would suffer and die. I'm glad he died soon after because I would have done it myself. He was always a monster to me and our whole family, and he almost harmed me multiple times as a child, as well as his own kids. He constantly looked for reasons to beat me because he just wanted to. I hope there's a hell and that he's in the deepest pit of it. I can't believe my grandmother misses and grieves for him even now. He was truly evil. Story 12. I used to work as a hospice nurse, and there was one family I was working with where the dad was sick with liver cancer, a lifelong alcoholic, sadly a typical outcome, with metastasis to the stomach, bone, and a lot of other areas. But those were the source of most of the pain we were struggling to control. We had finally graduated him up to fentanyl patches, and he was kind of tightrope walking between the bliss of opioids and brief interruptions of the agony that comes with cancer, completely destroying your body. Still, even in these situations, you get strange moments of lucidity that break through. One nurse told us about a lady who had gone to bed about a month prior. Generally, with cancer, once they go to bed, they don't come back from it, or if they do, it's never very far. They were having a family meeting with the nurse and other members of the treatment team when she suddenly sat up and told everyone, "I've been talking with the administrator, and he told me that everything is going to be fine." Then she lay back down and died. So while it was surprising, it wasn't totally out of place when this guy, who was in his 80s, sat up suddenly and had one of those moments. It's still surprising no matter how many times it happens. You're never truly prepared for it. Well, he sat straight up and looked around the room. Then I swear to God, I heard a little drum beat somewhere, and he began to shout, "I like to move it," and proceeded to sing the entire song as though from memory, with the family backing his vocals like one collective hype team. It was truly magical and the kind of story that people will never believe unless they were there to see it. Story 13. Ours is a bit roundabout. My dad passed away last year, and a month later, one of his cousins did. But before she passed, she informed my mom that my paternal grandfather had a secret second family. She was the last person who knew and felt that someone should know. Turns out my dad knew and intended to take it to the grave. He'd been told by his mom when she was on her deathbed and swore to keep it a secret. The cousin only knew because in the 1950s, Granddaddy made a stop to drop off some cash with that other family on the way home from my aunt's funeral, and the cousin was in the car. My mom and I managed to piece things together and track down this other, previously unknown branch of the family. We've established contact, and they were as surprised as we were. Good folks. Turns out my half-cousin is a fairly successful gospel singer. Not exactly dark, but it's my new Exhibit A when I explain to people that Southern families are built on secrets and lies. Story 14. When I was a teenager, I used to volunteer at a dementia ward and did my best to cheer up the residents there with walks or reading or whatever I could do. I also heard a lot of bizarre stories during that time, but there was no way of sorting truth from fiction for most of them. I just listened to the confessions, some of them absolutely heartbreaking, mind you, and didn't argue or question anything because there was no point and no way to confirm most of it anyway. I was particularly close to one resident, as she had been there a fairly long time compared to most of the others. We used to take long walks in the garden, and she would tell me all sorts of things that felt truly scandalous to a sheltered kid like me. I vowed I would take some of those confessions to the grave. 2 days before the lady died, she fell into a coma, but the last conversation we had together really stuck with me. She detailed her life on the farm and how she had struggled after her husband passed many years ago. This was true based on what her family had told me. But then she veered into uncharted territory and started telling me about this passionate emotional affair she had with a strong, good-looking black man named Mose, short for Moses, who offered to help her with work around the farm when it fell on hard times after her husband was killed, which was a shock. She had never told me how he died before. She said she never acted on any physical urges toward Mose due to still being in love with her husband, but praised Mose for helping her with her children and household, sticking by her after she took in another male boarder to help make ends meet, etc. I just sat and listened. She told me all about how she saved him from arrest after he stole from her. She forgave him, only for him to nearly die in a beating later on after helping her. She said he gifted her a handkerchief that belonged to his mother as a way of saying goodbye, and she cherished it as a symbol of all the unspoken feelings that passed between them. Needless to say, I was blown away by this riveting story. It brought tears to her eyes and mine just hearing her tell it. Skip ahead about 10 years, and I bump into one of this lady's kids at a community event. The daughter recognizes me as the cheerful volunteer who used to sit with her mom and keep her company. She comes over to say hello and thank me for the kindness I showed her mother. I told her it was my pleasure and shared with her some very touching words her mother had told me about each of her children, hoping it would bring a smile to her face. It did. She thanked me again, then, half jokingly, asked if her mother had confessed anything else before she died. I knew I could never share some of the things her mom told me, just too personal, and I hesitated to share what she had told me about the farmhand, but then thought her mother was so touched by the children's connection to the man, so why not? Maybe the daughter would remember him as well and relive the fond times. So I recounted her story in as much detail as I could recall and with all the compassion I could muster, recognizing it might come as a shock if she had been very young and did not remember the man. The daughter stared me down unblinkingly for what seemed like a small eternity until she burst out laughing. Apparently, this is the plot line of some Sally Field movie from the 80s. I'd never heard of that her mom latched onto in her final days. None of it was a real memory at all. The farmhand was played by a young Danny Glover, I think. I was floored, and that's how I learned about dementia confabulation. I was sad her mom's story wasn't a real memory, though, because she had told it to me with such gratitude for Mose. However, it did make me feel slightly more hopeful that some of the other residents' confessions might have been confabulation as well, especially the darker ones that gave me the heebie-jeebies. Story 15. My wife, a geriatrician, told me this story. She had a patient who was considered just the loveliest by all who knew her, including her children. Her children and their families are all successful individuals here in Melbourne, Australia, a lawyer, a doctor, a university dean, etc., a group of very neatly presented people, if you know what I mean. As the matriarch's dementia worsened, she began having extremely violent hallucinations and started sharing unfiltered tales of great violence. The family was very confused. But after she passed, the oldest son explained to his siblings that their mother had actually been taken as a young teen in East London by a gang leader and was forced into being his wife for many years. Throughout this ordeal, she actually studied and learned how to be part of that world, eventually becoming influential enough to stage a coup against him, take all of his money, and end his gang. She then escaped to Australia with the money to start over and managed to build and nurture a life of privilege for herself and generations to come. I admire this woman greatly. Story 16.
A few years ago, my mom knew a woman who was diagnosed with late-stage cancer. Before she passed away, she made a shocking confession to her husband. She told him that all three of their sons were not his biological children. Their real father was actually her own father. The boys were around 10, 8, and 7 years old at the time. After she died, the husband had DNA tests done, which confirmed that he was not the biological father. The tests also showed that the boy's biological father was indeed their maternal grandfather. The woman's father, who was in his 70s, was arrested and later sent to prison, where he eventually passed away. Despite learning the truth, the husband decided to raise the boys as his own. He said he had noticed early on that there was something different about them. For example, they didn't seem to feel pain the way other children did. At the time, he didn't think much of it, but looking back, it stood out more clearly. Story 17. Trauma ER nurse here. I had a critical trauma patient arrive in our bay. He was in his early 40s. He had been hit by a motorcycle while changing a tire on the side of the road. He was on the job, something like a roadside assistance position. The motorcycle rider was ejected, hurled about 20 feet, and unfortunately died at the scene. The crash caused a complete amputation of the patient's right lower leg, below the knee, and a 75% amputation of the left lower leg, which was hanging on by some remaining tissue. EMS arrived within 30 seconds. The crash had happened about a block from the fire station, and the crew heard it, ran to the victim, and drove the ambulance straight to the scene. Two tourniquets had been applied, and the patient was talking normally. We gave him emergency blood, and as we were heading up to the operating room, he looked at me and said, "I need you to tell my wife where my will is. It's..." And I interrupted him, saying, "Sir, hang in there. You are not going to die." The usual nurse reassurance. He immediately cut me off and said, "No, listen to me. I'm not going to make it through this. You need to tell her because she'll never find it." I stopped my usual talk and listened. He said, "Tell her it's under a wood plank under the carpet in the master bedroom closet. Tell her to pull up the corner carpet and pull it back and look under the board. It looks different from the other boards." I acknowledged him and said, "I will only tell her if you don't survive. I promise. But you're going to make it." He died in surgery. I went to the OR waiting room after hearing the news. The family was there, all crying. Even his boss had shown up because it happened on the job. I quietly asked someone standing nearby, "Which one is the wife?" He pointed. I walked up to her and asked if I could speak with her privately. She nodded and followed me a short distance away. I introduced myself and told her what her husband had told me. She cried harder and said, "Why would he hide it? I don't understand. We don't have much and just bought this house 3 months ago." I felt so bad for her. It turns out he had about $85,000 in bonds and CDs. The will he hid had all the account numbers and passwords to everything he owned. An attorney I knew personally sued the deceased motorcycle rider's insurance company, and the wife received $250,000. She also sued the employer's insurance and received $750,000 from that policy. Story 18. My grandfather was kicked in the groin by a cow as a teenager. Later, he found out he was infertile, but waited until after the arranged marriage with my grandmother was finalized before telling anyone on her side of the family. He had previously had another marriage proposal fall through when he shared that detail too soon. Since they still wanted to have children, my grandfather made a deal with his sister to let her husband sleep with his wife until she conceived. My dad was born, and then about a year later, my aunt. My grandparents and my great aunt and uncle made a pact that the last one of them alive would be responsible for telling the family. Then DNA testing became popular, and we started to notice that the math wasn't adding up. We asked my grandmother, who was the last one of the four alive, what it all meant, and that's when we finally got the backstory. But she would have died without saying a word, leaving all of us in the dark. Story 19. My partner is an ICU nurse, so she has heard quite a few stories. The one that always stuck with me was desperately sad. She was taking care of a man who had two lovely grown-up daughters and a really kind, loving wife. One night toward the end, my partner sat with him as he'd been getting agitated with discomfort in the days leading up to his final hours. He described how, as a young man in post-war England, he'd seen a girl who worked in the offices of the factory where he got his first job. She was the daughter of the factory owner. He was too shy to speak to her, but fell totally and utterly in love with her, enraptured by her movement, her way of speaking, everything about her.
He really impressed upon my partner how love at first sight is real and that there's no logic in love. He knew it wasn't logical to be willing to give anything to be with someone he couldn't even talk to, but he loved her nonetheless. Anyway, as he rose through the ranks of the factory, he finally got up enough courage to speak with her. They got on like a house on fire. He became even more deeply infatuated, obsessed even. He said he barely ate, struggled to concentrate, and felt downright sick at the thought of not being with her. After months of what he described as flirtatious exchanges and swapped glances, he decided to ask her out. He got suited up and decided to head to her father's, his boss's house, to present her with flowers and ask her out. Nervous, apprehensive, wanting to turn back several times, he got to the part of town where the large palatial home was. It seemed abuzz with activity, people arriving from all over. As he approached the door, his boss appeared from a side entrance and, slightly bemused at the gent's presence, ushered him around the side and said how kind it was of him to bring flowers. He was very confused. Taken around the house to a walled garden, it was clear there was a party going on. Gentle, sedate, like a garden party. After accepting a drink for Dutch courage and seeing the object of his affection appear, he approached her, having finally found the will. He said hello, and before he could say anything, the girl turned to grab another man and introduced him as her fiancé. It was an engagement party. He said hello, mumbled through the conversation, and stumbled home, leaving the party feeling like his ears were ringing and his world had imploded. He said he cried and drank that night. Thought about ending his life. Thought about hurting the fiancé. Thought about what grand and amazing gesture he could do to win her heart. He carried on working at the factory for a year or two. The girl got married, and so did he. He had the first of his daughters. He said he used to almost wince when he saw the woman and confessed that he still loved her deeply. He would nearly break down in the work toilets after a cordial exchange, or looking up from his desk to see her glancing in his direction. After some time, he settled on the idea that he simply wasn't of the same class as this woman, and only doing well financially might one day make him acceptable in her eyes. He left the factory, started his own engineering firm, and had another daughter with his wife, whom he always described as kind and forgiving. He lost contact with the woman from the factory, though he occasionally ran into her father at events. He said even seeing her dad sometimes would lift his heart like it was carried on a wave, before it crashed to the shore, dragging and slowing to a roll on the soaked sand. On more than one occasion, he drove to where he knew she lived with her husband, wanting to knock and declare his love, but he never did. After more than a decade without seeing her, he heard that her husband had passed away after a long illness. He now had two teenagers and a wife at home, had moved further away, and was a millionaire. He drove 2 hours through snow and sleet to get to where he believed she lived, only to sit in his car in her cul-de-sac, motionless, frozen. After a drink from a hip flask, he went to the door. No answer. Ashamed, sad, and bewildered, he stopped at one of his old watering holes for a drink. He couldn't face going home knowing he had just made a trek to see another woman. Inside, he started to recognize familiar faces. People said hello, congratulated him on the success of his company. Old friends gathered around to ask questions about his new life, to swap old stories. And after several pints, he looked up. And across the bar, there she was, still unmistakably her after all those years. A sadness to her. Now feeling reckless, he approached her. Managed to croak out, "Hello, do you remember me?" She responded with a soft smile and words to the effect of course, how have you been?" He smiled back, offered condolences on her husband, and started to pull together what he wanted to say, before she fairly abruptly said, "I'm so sorry, John. I'd love to stay and talk, but I've things to attend to, with the arrangements and all that." His name wasn't John, it was James. He returned to his wife and lived a further 30 or 40 years. He never again ran into the woman, but said he thought of her daily. He wrote to her hundreds of times but never sent the letters, sealing the envelopes and hiding them in his study. He said he had spent a lifetime thinking of her, all his efforts to make himself wealthy to be acceptable to her. But he never once truly got up enough courage to engage her in the conversation he truly wanted to have. When he passed, he left his money and properties to his wife and daughters, and his company was sold.
but he left a mysterious, small wooden chest and the key to it with his solicitor. His wife never found out what was in the chest. We never found out if it was instructed to be given to anyone beyond the solicitor. It's not a disturbing story as such, but it always struck me as very sad, and in some ways deeply cruel. Story 20. This wasn't a deathbed confession from the person himself, but from others in the family. When my great-grandfather died, everyone was sharing their favorite stories about him or memories they had. I can't remember who started the story, but about four other people kept jumping in to add more details. They told the story, in great detail, of how in the late 1930s in small-town Texas, he and some buddies were driving down the road, drinking and hitting mailboxes with baseball bats. They saw a black man. Some said he went to high school with them. Others thought he was older. But either way, as they zoomed past him, my great-grandfather hit the man in the head with the bat, just like they were doing to the mailboxes. The man died instantly. They even went straight to the police station to report what happened. The police shook their hands, said, "Job well done," and sent them on their way. Sadly, some of the people there, when I was 14 and heard the story, were so giddy and proud of it. I haven't talked to anyone in that family since, except my grandfather, and I only talk to him once a year to say Merry Christmas and thank him for the card. Story 21. My granny was dying, and I thought I was going to be brave and ask her about who my grandfather was and why no one ever spoke about him. I got more than I ever imagined at 15. She said, "Your granddaddy hurt your mother and all your aunts and uncles. He got your Auntie B pregnant when she was 12, and she had a baby that she gave away to the minister at church. The court said your grandfather was not allowed back in the state. He had to leave and go up north, or he would go to prison." I was angry and asked her why she didn't want to press charges so that he would spend his life in prison. She told me, "Times were different back then. They didn't treat things like that the way they do nowadays. Also, I didn't want to put my children through reliving the nightmare they had already endured for so long." At the time, I thought she was right in not wanting them to relive what they had experienced. The next day my granny passed away, I mentioned to my mother that I had asked about her father. I said, "Mama, it must have been terrible for Granny to not be able to do anything except send Grandpa out of state." My mom covered her face, crying, and said that Granny knew the whole time what was being done to them. She said Granny refused to press charges against him, and since she was an uncooperative witness and wouldn't allow her children to speak with officials, the courts couldn't do much. Story 22. My grandfather told me when he got cancer and I was taking care of him at his house, he didn't want to die in a hospital or a nursing home, that when he was growing up, around 16 years old, the neighbor's wife used to come running over to his house, all bloody, with her two very young kids who had marks all over them. The wife's husband was a drunk who would hurt them. The wife was only 18, and they had gotten married at 15, apparently, so they were all fairly young. He said this went on for a long time, and even my great-grandfather went over to confront the man, but it never stopped. One late night, it was raining, and he was woken up by the sound of tires screeching at the corner of their property, where the road had a long curve. He heard the crash, got up, and ran outside. The husband was the one driving. My grandfather said when he looked inside the car, he could tell the man was badly hurt. He just laid on his stomach and watched for nearly an hour as the life slowly left the man. Then he went back inside, woke my great-grandfather, and told him the drunk next door had flipped his car. He said my great-grandfather simply said, "Finally," and rolled back over. My grandfather asked if he should go tell anyone, and my great-grandfather said to let the wife decide if she wanted to call for help. He said he went over, woke her up, and told her that her husband had flipped the car down the road and was gone. She gave him the tightest hug and said, "Thank the Lord." That woman later became my grandmother. A few years later, they got married and had my mom. But my uncles aren't technically related to my grandfather, though as far as they can recall, he was their dad. Story 23. My former wife's grandfather told his family about this 2 days before he passed. He had an affair years ago when his family was young, 5 kids, and he and his wife were separated. Eventually, they decided to make it work, and he moved back home. The woman he had the affair with, his secretary, moved away. The relationship didn't survive, and a few years later, he and the secretary reconnected and got married. They lived a long, happy life. He retired young and spent 50 years with his second wife, living an amazing life. After she passed a couple of years ago,
A family member came to him and told him they had done a DNA test and found a relative, a half-sibling. His secretary had been pregnant when she moved away, gave the baby up for adoption, and never told him about the child. He only found out weeks before his own death and never made contact with the child, an adult now, of course. I was shocked. They were such sweet, kind people who always treated me with warmth and respect, even after the divorce from their granddaughter. I don't know if I've ever been so close to a betrayal of this magnitude. It seems incomprehensible to never tell the man you love, who you sacrificed so much for, that you carried a child with him. Story 24. Not mine, but told to me by a hospice nurse. She was taking care of an elderly male patient who, one night, began screaming hysterically. They rushed in, and he was sobbing uncontrollably about the children being in his room and that they were here for him. No one was there, of course. They eventually calmed him down. Over the next few days, he became very withdrawn. When hospice patients begin seeing people in their rooms, it's usually a sign that they're nearing the end, and he did start to decline. At that point, he confessed to her. During World War II, he served in Europe. One day, his unit came across a small village and massacred everyone there. The children were lined up, and he shot them. He said he hadn't wanted to do it, but if he had refused orders, they would have shot him instead. The memory had haunted him his entire life, and the children he was seeing were the ones he had harmed. He was adamant that they had come to drag him to hell for what he had done and was inconsolable. What can you even say to that? She comforted him the best she could. He passed very shortly after. According to her, he started crying again about seeing the children in the room, but this time he wasn't scared. He said, "They're smiling. They're smiling." He passed in a routine way. Maybe it was a hallucination caused by his guilt. Maybe the spirits had forgiven him. Who knows? Excuse the phrasing, but this story has always haunted me. Story 25. I had a lot of great aunts on my grandma's side, like 7. They ranged in age, but the youngest was about 20 years younger than the oldest. They all got along great, except the youngest always hated the oldest. She was totally cold toward her. It was kind of a running joke in the family that you could only see 6 of the great aunts at one time, because if the youngest and oldest were in the same room, something would definitely go down. When my great-grandma was dying, she was the middle child, I think, she told us how, when she was a kid, her oldest sister ran away from home, and nobody saw her for a couple of years. She came back 6 months pregnant. Her parents adopted the baby and raised it as their own youngest child. That put a lot of things into perspective, at least from the youngest aunt's point of view. We figured it was lingering anger over being given up and lied to for the first 15 to 20 years of her life. Kind of cold, but we understood. Several years later, the oldest aunt was dying. She told us she'd run away from home for a boy who ended up abusing her terribly, hurting her for the entire time she was gone. She said she escaped when she got pregnant and ran back to her parents. We don't know if the youngest aunt ever knew that part of the story. Story 26. Not my story. This was told to me by a friend. She used to visit her great uncle all the time, and he would often mistake her for his sister, her mother. One of the times he did, he told her that he always believed her and said, "I've made sure evil can't spread." He passed away a week later, and she eventually brought the conversation up with her mother. Long story short, when her mother was younger, she was being abused by her oldest brother, not the same brother who passed. She had told multiple people in the family, but they told her to keep quiet. A week after she finally told her other brother, the eldest brother had apparently run away. The family told her never to ask about him again. When she brought him up to her other brother, he told her that he can't do evil anymore. Her mother had long suspected that her brother had hurt, or possibly killed him, and this conversation pretty much confirmed it for her. Story 27. My former neighbor, a stay-at-home dad with 3 boys who all had various disabilities, used to be the kind of super dad all us kids admired. He was a gamer, loved to collect cards, and was the cool dad who liked wrestling and all the classic 90s stuff. His kids were the only ones who were nice to my brother, who struggled to make friends due to behavioral issues. So we all basically gathered at their house, played games, usually GoldenEye 64, and traded cards. They eventually moved away, and we were heartbroken. But my parents would occasionally take us to visit for the day. We'd spend hours in the pool being tossed around or playing wrestling games on the PS2.
As time passed, we lost contact, but I ran into the dad when I was around 17. He was working again and had lost weight due to health reasons. He added my brother and me on Facebook, and we started talking about games and catching up. Later, he told me that he had lost weight because his health was failing. Then he told me something that shattered my childhood. He confessed that he had very inappropriate thoughts about me as a child. He said he knew it was wrong, but he needed to clear his conscience. Suddenly, this man, who used to teach us wrestling moves, toss us in the pool, and play chicken in the water, became someone entirely different in my mind. From what I can remember, he never touched me inappropriately, but I started doubting myself. Even the innocent times when he picked me up to throw me in the pool became disgusting memories because of his confession. The worst part? When I told my brother what he had said, my brother replied, "I'm not surprised. He was always kind of a kid in his mind, so it's not shocking he saw you that way when you were a kid." I couldn't believe it. The man passed away a month or two later, but I'll never forget how he ruined years of great childhood memories by confessing his thoughts to me and left me to carry that weight while he rests in peace. Story 28. It wasn't exactly a deathbed confession, but he passed a month later and we were expecting it. My grandpa and I didn't have a close relationship emotionally, but in appearance and overall vibe, we were very alike. We were the only ones in the family who looked not white, according to everyone else, which they always joked about. I wasn't around much since I had moved countries, so we never had the chance to bond when I became an adult. One summer, I visited him with my dad, and for the first time, we drank together. His homemade local alcohol, made from raisins and distilled himself. Very strong stuff. We got really drunk. I told him about college and some personal relationship stuff. That's when he opened up. He told me that in his 30s or 40s, don't remember the exact timeline, while he was still married to my grandmother, he went on an around-the-world trip. While traveling across Europe and Asia, he had slept with many women and used no protection. He confessed that he would intentionally lie about his identity. It was easier to get away with that back then, so they wouldn't be able to find him afterward. He admitted he had developed a fetish for getting women pregnant. I should mention that he was a professional bodybuilder in his 20s and kept a large portion of his physique well into his 50s, so apparently it was easy for him to attract women around the world. According to him, I have many unknown uncles, aunts, and cousins scattered across every continent except for Australia and Antarctica. Story 29. Well, I can't give too many details, but we had a family member who was in hospice care. With the comfort medications and everything, they began saying they had killed 6 people over the years. We initially chalked it up to the drugs. But the claims continued, so naturally, questions were asked. The local police were informed, we assume by the nursing staff, maybe as per contract, or possibly by a visitor saying goodbye. We're not sure. Anyway, an investigation was launched. The bodies of 3 individuals were found exactly where the family member had said. Since they were still under hospice care, the police continued the investigation. They found another body, and a constable was ordered to stand by the dying family member. Maybe in hopes of getting more information, we don't know. The family member excused themselves and ended up taking their own life. A note was found telling where the remaining bodies were, but no explanation was ever given as to why these people were killed. This all unfolded over the course of several weeks. Story 30. My wife's grandmother only learned the name of her real father on her mom's deathbed. Grandma was in her 70s at the time. The man had been a traveling salesman who fell in love with great-grandma. They eloped, and his friend, who he claimed was a pastor, married them. She became pregnant, and when she told him, he confessed that his friend wasn't actually a pastor. Then he skipped town. Great-grandma's father put a made-up name on the birth certificate because they never wanted anything to do with the man again. Grandma refused to tell anyone his real name. For decades, the family blamed every mysterious health problem on the guy with no name. Finally, Grandma revealed his name on her mother's deathbed. Turns out he had been using a fake identity. My wife's uncle then did a ton of research, including DNA testing, to track down the man's real family. They eventually found them and made contact. The other family had no idea he had lived a double life. Grandma got to meet her half-niece, or whatever the correct term is, and they became friends. They've even had a few get-togethers. Grandma's amazing. She's still sharp as a tack and is strong at 103 years old. Love that woman. Story 31. Not quite a deathbed confession, but close. A local couple adopted a girl in the early 1980s, and she supposedly ran away from home in 1989. The disappearance kind of made sense at the time. Money was missing along with a bag and some clothes, and authorities couldn't find anything suspicious. Fast forward to the last 5 years, the girl's biological mother began searching for her, and the trail led to this couple. Almost immediately, she suspected something was off and began to believe that the adoptive father had harmed her daughter. It turned out that the adoptive dad had a history of predatory behavior and had moved around a lot. Investigators discovered that the adoptive mom had known but stayed silent. The adoptive father was eventually arrested as a very old man. After his incarceration, he admitted that he had taken the girl's life back in 1989 and buried her in a barrel on the property. Then when they moved, he actually dug her up and reburied her at the new house. His wife never realized that the girl had been buried just 20 feet from their back door the entire time. I've never been able to forget that story, especially since her original burial site is right on my daily commute. Story 32. My father died last summer. He was a Vietnam vet. I was always told that he was in supply. My mother often shared a cute story about how he somehow managed to get a flight home to visit her because of his connections. Apparently, he showed up unannounced at her door with a new mustache. That story seemed to fit. My father was a delightfully sneaky fellow, charming and resourceful, a philandering ladies' man who somehow always brought home free food from his job at a grocery store. He also had terribly bowed legs from rickets, so I assumed he was deemed incapable of more physical jobs. He died of cancer. He became angry and melancholy the year before his death. When my mother was diagnosed with cancer as well, he cried, saying she was the only woman he had ever truly loved. They had divorced when I was a toddler, but they remained best friends until they'd get mad at each other and vow to never speak again. That probably happened 100 times in my 42 years. Back to his confession. Toward the end, his bouts of anger were scary, pathetic, and sad. They tore me up inside. He screamed at me once, "I've killed more people than you can imagine." And that was it. He didn't elaborate, and I didn't ask. I pretended like it wasn't said. He had not lost any cognitive function, so I am almost certain it was the truth. It turns out he served with an Army combat helicopter unit. He was buried with a military funeral. He was proud of his military service, despite being drafted into a war he didn't care about. I am proud of him. Sometimes I hated him for being a crappy father, but I miss him for the loving grandfather he became. I really miss him. Story 33. My mom was from China, though we are now happily living in a European country. We went back to China for my grandmother's last few weeks as she was dying from terminal cancer. On my grandma's final days, she requested that my mom stay with her alone, and it was only then that she revealed my mom wasn't her biological child. My grandmother confessed that she had bought my mom from a child trafficking ring, which was sadly common in China, because she had tried for many years and still couldn't get pregnant. My mother cried a lot, both for the unimaginable pain that her biological parents must have gone through in losing her, and also because my grandparents went above and beyond in treating her like their little princess. They truly did raise my mom as their own. They were never abusive and only gave her the very best in life. They even willingly sent her to the U.S. for university, even though they weren't wealthy by any means. Story 34. I'm using a throwaway for this one. My grandpa's whole career was in the military. He joined just after World War II, having just turned 18 as the war ended. He and his 6 brothers all enlisted at the same time. Their first time seeing combat was in Korea. My grandpa was a paratrooper and one of his brothers was a field medic. For some reason, the 6 didn't get placed in the same squads. He said that during an intense firefight, his squad crossed paths with his brothers. His brother was helping an injured squad member when he was shot 3 times, twice in the back and once in the chest. My grandpa ran to drag him behind cover and held him in his arms. They both knew he wouldn't survive. His brother died a few minutes later, and something in my grandpa's mind just snapped. He said for the rest of the war, he used the enemy as a way to deal with the pain and rage from his brother's death. He transformed from a terrified, inexperienced soldier into a relentless fighter. He didn't say how many people he killed. All he said was, "The day my brother died was the day I became a killer." He wouldn't give a number, saying, "If I told you, you'd see me as a very different man." I wasn't a man at that point. I was a cold-hearted person out for revenge. He said that when the opportunity came, he would inflict as much pain as possible on enemy troops. When they were injured and on the ground, he admitted to beating them, kicking them, breaking bones, and causing intentional suffering, only when no other allies were around to see. He didn't want anyone to witness that side of him. He received a Purple Heart and several prestigious military honors after the war. He believed if anyone had known about his actions, those awards would have been taken away. He said Korea was the only time he didn't feel human. He described himself as a dark force and said disturbingly that he liked it. This shocked us. He was the kindest, gentlest man I had ever known. He never swore, never got angry, and was incredibly loving. His marriage was strong, and he raised my dad and aunt with care and affection. No one would have guessed he once relished hurting people. He confessed these things only once as a way of clearing his conscience before he passed. Not even my grandma had known. I believe the stress of war and the trauma of losing his brother triggered something in him. He went in with a desire to serve his country and came out as someone changed by pain and rage. I can't ask him more. He's long gone. But I believe he did even worse things than he admitted. Story 35. Shortly after he was diagnosed with the final stages of heart failure, a few weeks before he died, my grandfather told me several stories about World War II that changed my view of him and of war in general. Before I begin, I should say that my grandfather was one of the kindest men you'd ever meet. Always friendly, never drank, the kind of guy who would give you the shirt off his back. He handed out the biggest candy bars in town on Halloween. Everyone loved him. Shortly after D-Day, my grandfather was part of a 12-man rifle squad fighting in northern France. As his unit entered a seemingly abandoned village, they were ambushed by a German squad and the unit was torn apart. They won the fight, but by the end, only three of the Americans were still alive, and one of them was badly wounded. The squad leader and his assistant had been killed. The two unwounded soldiers swept the battle scene and dragged three badly wounded German Wehrmacht soldiers into the middle of the street. My grandfather looked at the other American soldier, said no prisoners, and cut the throat of one of the Germans right there. He told me he nearly vomited because there was far more blood than he expected. His partner lifted his rifle to shoot the other two, but my grandfather stopped him. He said there may have been other German soldiers nearby and didn't want the gunfire to attract them. So they dragged the other two into a shallow ditch on the side of the road, about 6 inches of water in it, and stood on the German soldiers' heads until they drowned. After that, he said he hated Germans. He confessed to a number of actions during the war, including shooting civilians and not sparing enemy soldiers who were trying to surrender, apparently not an uncommon occurrence in that environment. But the worst? He said he only ever felt guilty about one thing he'd done. In early 1945, his new squad was moving through a small German village when he and a couple of other soldiers kicked in the door to a small house. Inside was an elderly German woman in a wheelchair who immediately began yelling and cursing at them in perfect English. My grandfather kicked her wheelchair over, rolled it out the door, and then knocked over an oil lamp as he left the house with his partners. The woman died in the fire. He looked at me with cold eyes and said, "That was too cruel. She was an old woman. I should have just shot her." Story 36. When my grandma on my mom's side died, she had spent at least 3 weeks in a semi-conscious state, more like a quasi-dream state, before finally passing. During those weeks, she would constantly tell my mother that a boat was waiting for her. Her house was on a lake, and her deathbed was in a room that overlooked it. She kept asking if it was all right for her to get on the boat. This persisted, along with my grandmother having full conversations with relatives who had died years before I was even born. One day, my grandma asked my mother again if it was all right to leave on the boat, and my mother finally replied, "It's all right if you want to." My grandma passed away a couple of...
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy. Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal. Regain, powered by BetterHelp, offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both. See why people wish they'd tried couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Hours later, eerie little tidbit. My grandmother's watch, which was in another room at the time of her death, stopped at the exact time she died. Apparently, it's pretty common for strange things to happen around the time of death in our family. When an uncle, who I never met, passed, a car of his that hadn't worked in years suddenly started on its own. And when my grandma on my dad's side died, the doorbell at my parents' gate rang, but no one was there. You can see the gate from the kitchen, so it would have been impossible for someone to ring it and run away unseen. Story 37. I'm just taking this as a therapeutic opportunity. Feel free to ignore. My paternal grandmother was an amazing woman. She lived an incredible life and endured the loss of her son to violence. She finally found the courage to divorce my awful grandfather 3 years after the murder, but she didn't get to enjoy her freedom. She was in a car accident caused by hypoglycemia from her type 1 diabetes and declined rapidly after that. In 2006, she declined suddenly and was hospitalized for the last time. We had just gone through a major storm and had no power for a week. The day the power came back, the house phone rang. My great uncle called and told us we needed to get there quickly. We arrived within 2 hours and were told to go in and see her one at a time. My grandma, who I had always been extremely close to, the woman who saved me when I tried to take my own life as a teenager, didn't recognize me. She introduced herself and asked if we'd met. I started crying. I'm crying now, I miss her. And then she recognized me. I think she cried too, but my memory is blurry at this point, and I'm not certain. What I do remember is our conversation after that. She told me to keep doing good things. I hadn't even started college yet, and those words felt like such a heavy weight. I couldn't figure out what she meant for the longest time, and still can't, honestly. I'm trying, but I'm always worried I won't do right by her. She struggled through so much. She endured everything my sociopathic grandfather put her through. She left me a journal. I feel extremely honored to be the one she trusted with it, but I'm also worried I won't do justice to the horrors she experienced. She dealt with more than I could ever comprehend. Marrying a man at 19 because she thought she had to. Conceiving 4 out of 5 children unwillingly, almost being forced to terminate the 5th because her husband didn't want to support another child and lied about getting a vasectomy. She found out her husband had kept a secret mistress out of state for over a decade. He hired arsonists to burn down the family business and the family farm, with all of the most precious family heirlooms inside. She endured the violent death of a child and that child's spouse, and everything else beyond that. She was the most amazing woman, and she died at 62, just when she was finally free. I was 2 months into my 18th year when I was asked if I thought it was okay to take her off life support, even though my dad and godfather had already said yes. I said yes, too, because I listened carefully to the doctor's explanation of her prognosis. I stayed in the room with her as she passed. She opened her eyes wide, appeared to scan the room, and sighed. A high-pitched sound that I still hear in my mind. It reminds me of the sound my dog makes when she's highly anxious. I don't feel good about it, even though the doctor told me it was likely a neurological reflex. I believe that explanation. I've seen enough people pass in my career to know it happens, but I still can't help but feel I let her down. That sound still echoes in my memory, and I wonder if I should have done more, even though I know there was nothing left to do. Anyway, I'm full on crying now. I still miss her so much. She understood me like no one else in my family ever has. Story 38. When I was 19, I worked at a private care home outside Kansas City. It was mostly elderly patients, many with no family left. One of them was Mr. Alvin Mercer. Quiet, polite, always sat by the window and watched the birds. He never got visitors and barely spoke more than yes or no for the first few months. 2 days before he died, I was assigned to night duty. Around 2 a.m., Alvin buzzed for assistance. When I entered, he looked me dead in the eye and said, "You're kind. You should hear the truth." I assumed it was nonsense, part of the delirium that often comes before death. But then he reached under his blanket and pulled out an old yellowed envelope. He placed it in my hands and whispered, "Burn this when I'm gone. Promise me." I asked him what was inside. A confession, something no one else ever knew. He started shaking, and I told him to rest, but he kept going.
4th of July deals are on at Lowe's. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances, including the Samsung Bespoke French Door Refrigerator, featuring Beverage Center and Dual Ice Maker. Plus, when you buy more, you save more. Now's the perfect time to upgrade your home with top Samsung appliances and hot 4th of July savings at Lowe's. Valid through 7/9. See Lowe's.com for details. Savings vary based on purchase amount. Selection varies by location.